Well, let's go back to the passage we read earlier from the book of Genesis, and I want to read some verses from Genesis chapter 45, and beginning at verse 4. Genesis 45 and verse 4. Then Joseph said to his brothers, "Come close to me." When they had done so, he said, "I am your brother, Joseph, the one you sold into Egypt. And now, do not be distressed, and do not be angry with yourselves for selling me here, because it was to save lives that God sent me ahead of you. For 2 years now there has been a famine in the land, and for the next 5 years there will not be plowing and reaping. But God sent me ahead of you to preserve for you a remnant on earth and to save your lives by a great deliverance." Well, we're going to look this morning at reconciliation and forgiveness in the life of Joseph, as Joseph meets his brothers. He was 17 years old when he was sold by them as a slave. He was 30 when he came to prominence in Egypt and became second only to Pharaoh. Now there have been 7 years of abundance, and now the famine has been going for 2 years. So he hasn't seen them for all those years, some 20 years or so, that he hasn't seen them. And now they meet, and you think, well, what's going to happen? You can imagine what they might have felt when Joseph said to them, "I am Joseph," and all the power that he had. But it's a wonderful example of reconciliation and forgiveness. You know, the things that we do sometimes have long-term consequences. Things that happened long ago are still impacting us and impacting our families and others we know. Jacob, Joseph's father, had gone to his relatives seeking a wife, and he had found a woman whom he loved, Rachel. But Rachel's father, Laban, because it was the custom that the older daughter would be married first, had tricked Jacob into marrying Leah, Rachel's older sister. And then Jacob married Rachel later. He never really loved Leah, and there was jealousy between the wives and also between the children. And it was quite clear that Jacob had favorites, and the children of his wife Rachel were his favorites, Joseph and Benjamin. And then Rachel died. But still, Jacob was having Joseph as his favorite. And so in this family, there were children, not by two wives, but four wives, because Jacob had children by the handmaids of Leah and of Rachel. And the sons of Leah, the oldest children, were dominant. When Joseph was born, he had all these older brothers. And there was jealousy. And we're told earlier in the account of Joseph's life that the brothers hated him. Not just they didn't get on with him and they didn't like him, they hated him and wouldn't even speak to him. And when God revealed his purpose for Joseph through dreams, they hated him even more because of his dreams. And so they planned to kill him when he went to visit them, taking supplies from his father. They saw him coming and they stripped him of his special robe that his father had given him, put him into a pit where there was no water, and they were going to kill him. But instead, they decided to sell him into slavery. And so they sold him as a slave, and then they took his coat and they daubed animal blood on it, took it back to his father, and said, "We found this coat. Is it your son's coat?" And they knew that it was only one coat like it. And Jacob was absolutely distraught and heartbroken. And Joseph was taken away into Egypt, and he went through various trials and difficulties, sold as a slave to Potiphar. The favorite son becomes a slave. Then Potiphar recognizes the outstanding character of Joseph, puts him in charge of his whole household. Then Potiphar's wife falsely accuses him, and Joseph is put in prison. And there he interprets the dreams of the butler and the baker, and both come true. And Joseph says to the butler, as the butler goes back to serve Pharaoh again, "Don't forget me, speak about me," but he doesn't. For 2 whole years he languishes again in prison, and then eventually the butler remembers him. And these actions all had consequences. They were all unresolved issues, particularly in the life of Jacob and his sons. And for more than 20 years, they, as we shall see, were experiencing guilt and fear and blaming each other. And it's really a very dysfunctional family. It's interesting that these men are the men after whom the 12 tribes of Israel are named, because they were the 12 sons of Israel, but they were a really mixed bunch, and there were all kinds of things that went on, but God was fulfilling his purpose through them. And you know, our lives often have those sort of elements of dysfunctionality, relationships, things that happened a long time ago, and sometimes those things have never, ever been resolved, but the consequences of them still continue, and they come to mind from time to time. As far as Joseph was concerned, again and again we're told in the account of his life that the Lord was with Joseph. Even when everything seemed to be going wrong, the Lord was with him. And Joseph had prospered in Egypt, despite all the setbacks that had come. In fact, when he interpreted Pharaoh's dreams and then suggested a plan to lay up reserves during the years of plenty for the years of famine, Pharaoh said, "Can we find anyone like this man in whom is the Spirit of God?" There's something about Joseph. The Lord is with him and he has wisdom. And that's why Pharaoh puts him in charge of the whole thing. And he was second only to Pharaoh. And there's a lovely description of the elevation of Joseph. Pharaoh says, "I hereby put you in charge of the whole land of Egypt." Takes his signet ring from his signet ring from his finger and puts it on Joseph's finger. Dresses him in robes of fine linen, puts a gold chain around his neck, has him ride in a chariot as his second in command, and men shouted before him, "Make way!" And he's in charge of everything. This is the man who's been sold by his brothers, who wanted to kill him, but sold him as a slave. He's worked as a slave, he's been in prison. And now here he is in this most amazing position of prominence, the second most powerful man in the world of his time. And he had married, and he had 2 sons. And when he named his sons, they said something about his experience. His firstborn was Manasseh, and he called him that because God has made me forget all my trouble and my father's household. He hasn't totally forgotten them, but he's saying the pain of it all has been resolved for him. And then his second son is named Ephraim, and it is because God has made me fruitful in the land of my suffering. In other words, God has helped Joseph to cope with the pain and the sadness in his life and has blessed him. And you know, it sometimes happens, doesn't it, that through the darker chapters of our life, that God is at work, and in the words of one of our hymns, that God sanctifies to us our deepest distress. That actually our sense of who he is and how he is with us and of the grace that he gives is seen in a very real way, and sometimes the most difficult and painful of experiences. There's a man in our church in St. Mellons who has had motor neuron disease for the last 3 or 4 years. And it has gradually brought him to the point where he is totally disabled and totally dependent upon the care of his wife and of others. And yet, you know, visiting him is to visit someone who has a wonderfully sweet spirit. It's amazing to see the way the Lord is sustaining him. He was a musician, very able musician. He can't do any of that. He's in a wheelchair when he goes out. He's in a chair in the house. He can't move. He's totally dependent, and yet the Lord is with him. And when we visited him on Friday, he was talking about how the Lord had spoken to him through ministry that he was able to access. He has one of these iPad-type machines, and he can control it just with his eyes, and it does all sorts of things. But the Lord is speaking to him, and he's sustained. It's a terrible disease, and yet the Lord is evidently with him. And the Lord often is with us in the circumstances we would never want, and somehow he becomes supremely precious to us. And it had helped Joseph not only to cope with one thing after another, but also to come to that point where he was ready to forgive his brothers. It's the most remarkable thing. It's he who is comforting them. The conversation is not at all normal in human terms. It's not what you would expect. You would expect Joseph to tell them off and to put them straight, but he reassures them. You sometimes hear people saying, we can't forgive until a person repents. I'm not sure that's right. The brothers hadn't repented. They regretted what they had done. But Joseph was ready to forgive them. He had come to terms with what they had done to him. And he'd seen the bigger picture of what God's purpose was through all these strange events, the providences through which he had taken Joseph and Jacob and the brothers as well. And one of the things sometimes that we struggle about in the past is something that happened where somebody did something which we believe is wrong, or they said something, or we think they did, and it's never been dealt with. And it's quite clear as you read this passage that the problem is primarily with the brothers, not with Joseph. And the reason is because Joseph has been sustained by God. He must have had some sense of his own need of God's grace and was able to trust in God and in all his trouble, not to be becoming bitter about it. That's what happens sometimes. People become bitter. That happens sometimes in churches, and sometimes people stop going to a church because something happened and they're bitter about it. And Joseph is a wonderful example of a man who wasn't bitter. And so past actions have long-term consequences sometimes. But God blesses us through painful experiences. And he also tests us and provides for us. This famine that affected the ancient world inevitably affected Jacob and his family. They were living in the land of promise. And it was a fruitful land, but once the drought came, and there are parts of our world today that are suffering drought, and nothing is growing, and the animals are dying, and the people are in terrible need. And it was like that for these 7 years of famine because of drought. And it was a test of their faith to trust God. But not only that, it became the means of Joseph and his brothers being reconciled, because it brought the brothers to Egypt. And it's a wonderful example in this story of providence, how God is overruling and working and bringing wonderful things to pass, even through the most difficult of circumstances. And sometimes as we look back in our lives, we may be able to see his hand in our lives, in the way he's led us and guided us to places perhaps which we never anticipated being in, and yet which in the purpose of God has been blessed to us and to others. And through all this complex series of events, that is what God is doing, and Joseph is conscious of it. And we have in the brothers an example of the painfulness of living with unforgiven sin. They knew what they had done. They'd lied to their father. And as you read the accounts leading up to them going to Egypt, you see all that coming out. For instance, when they first meet Joseph and don't know who he is, though he recognizes them, they've come to buy grain in Egypt. And he accuses them of being spies. And you might think, well, that's a bit extreme. But, you know, there are people trying to leave Russia at the moment and trying to go into other countries, and they're being questioned about who they are. because of a fear of neighbouring countries, that people will come in who will cause trouble. And so that's something that happens in life. And Joseph is saying, well, perhaps you're not really who you say you are. And this is what they say to him: your servants have come to buy food. We are all the sons of one man. Your servants are honest men, not spies. No, he said, you've come to see where our land is unprotected. And they replied, your servants were 12 brothers, the sons of one man who lives in the land of Canaan. The youngest is now with our father, and one is no more. And they don't tell the whole truth there. One of our brothers isn't around anymore, but they don't say why it was. And Joseph knows that he's the one. So in other words, they haven't told the father the truth. They haven't been living with it, but they know amongst each other what happened. And they've got this conspiracy of silence, but it's still affecting them. And it comes out in their conversations with Joseph and with their father. When it comes to sending Benjamin to Egypt, it's obvious that the father doesn't trust them. Ever since Joseph disappeared, and they never found the body, they just had a coat with the blood on it, and Jacob knows that there's more that they could tell him and they're not telling him. There's no trust between the father and the sons. And he's never going to let Benjamin out of his sight, because he doesn't, and that's gone on for decades in this family. And Jacob is afraid of them, and he blames them. I'm not sending Benjamin with you. He would perhaps send him with others, but not with them, because they were untrustworthy. And they were trying to deal with their guilt by trying to do the right thing. When they say we are honest men, that's not necessarily a lie. What they may be saying is, we did a terrible, terrible thing years ago. But ever since then, we've been trying to make up for it by doing the right thing. I remember one day traveling down the M4, past Llantrisant and down to the next junction, junction 35. And in those days, I haven't seen it for a long time now, there used to be a police camera van on the bridge just before you got to junction 35. And you come around a bend, and then suddenly the camera would be there. And I knew that a camera might be there. I was keeping the speed limit. And this young man came past very fast in a car, came round the bend, and I thought, oh dear, he's going to have a problem. And then as he saw the white van, he put his brakes on. And I think it was too late. I don't know, but I think it probably was. And then he came off the junction 35 as I did, and I followed him all the way into Bridgend. And he drove immaculately. He kept the speed limit all the way. But if he was booked, it was too late. But that's what we try to do sometimes, to make up, don't we? I've done wrong, but I'll try to do better from now on. And maybe that's what the brothers had been doing, but it hadn't resolved the issue. It hadn't resolved their guilt regarding Joseph. And they didn't want to face up to it. And it comes out in their conversations when they're coming back and forth with Joseph, and he's saying he wants to see this younger brother they're talking about just to show that they're telling the truth. But of course, he actually wants to see Benjamin, his brother, who is so special to him. And they're sort of trying to weigh up what's going on. And as they're weighing it all up, this is what they say: surely we are being punished because of our brother. We saw how distressed he was when he pleaded with us for his life, but we would not listen. That's why this distress has come upon us. You know, the guilty conscience. God's punishing us. He pleaded with us, and you get an insight into what happened when Joseph was sold as a slave. He pleaded, please don't do this, please don't do this, but they took no notice. And he went away into Egypt to be a slave. And Reuben says, didn't I tell you not to sin against the boy, but you wouldn't listen. Now we must give an accounting for his blood. And they don't realize that Joseph can understand them. He's speaking through an interpreter, but he can understand what they're saying. And he turns away and he weeps. But you see that guilt, that's what guilt does. It tries to make up by just doing what is right from now on. It blames. It has that sense of feeling we're being punished by God, that he is against us. And, well, they can't They can't resolve it in those ways. And even at times wanting to make atonement for what they've done in practical ways, when they know they have to take Benjamin back. And Jacob says there's no way that he's going to go back. And Jacob says, everything is against me. And Reuben says to his father, you may put both of my sons to death. What a terrible thing to say. You can put both of my sons to death if I do not bring him back to you. Entrust him to my care, and I will bring him back to you. But again, trying to make up for the wrong that they'd done, but none of it could actually deal with their sins. And they've got that sense of a fear of punishment. And even when the money is put back into their sacks, as you remember, that just fills them with a further sense of terror and anxiety, because as they're returning after the first visit and they find the silver back in the sacks, the exact same amount, which actually was an act of kindness that Joseph was showing to them, they are just overwhelmed with fear. And it's the working of a guilty conscience, a sense we've done wrong, and not facing up to the truth, and not confessing it, and not dealing with it. We have a hymn, Jesus, my great high priest, offered his blood and died. My guilty conscience seeks no sacrifice beside. His powerful blood did once atone, and now it pleads before the throne. It's only the blood of Christ that cleanses our conscience from guilt. And these men are guilty. And Joseph, God is with him, and he's at peace, and he's been blessed, and he's been exalted. And now it is he who becomes the source of comfort to them. I wonder, have you got things in your past that you've never, ever faced up to, and you still feel guilty, and you haven't reconciled, haven't you dealt with it? And it's a terribly sad and miserable situation to be in, and that's where the brothers are. But in their case, and perhaps in your case too, God is moving events forward to bring them to that point of reconciliation. And eventually Jacob agrees for Benjamin to go. And so he comes to Egypt. And then there's the question of the cup which has been put in his sack, and the likelihood of him being kept. And that's where we read what happens and how Judah begins to speak to Joseph and to explain the situation, to plead with him, and then even to offer that he will stay instead of Benjamin so that his father's heart will not be broken. You know, Joseph can see that a change has come about in his brothers. Not a change that deals with the things they've done. They're still struggling with that. But they're not the same brothers who sold him into slavery. And here they are, bowing down before him with their faces to the ground. That's exactly what one of Joseph's dreams said would happen. As the sheaves stood up in the field, and then all their sheaves bowed down to his. And they said, you mean you're going to rule over us? And here he is ruling over us, but they don't know it's Joseph. But Joseph can see God's purpose is being fulfilled, and why God is doing what he's doing, why these things have happened to him. And God is fulfilling his promise, and he's also providing for Jacob and his family. And that's what Joseph says, that God has sent me ahead of you to preserve for you a remnant on earth and to save your lives by great deliverance. I'm here organizing the events following or during the famine, and it's to preserve the people of God, it's to preserve the church of God. And God is in it all. And what has happened really to Jacob and to his sons is that they've lost sight of God and his promises. Jacob's saying, everything's against me. It's all gone wrong. He's bitter. And they're struggling with their unresolved guilt and something they've done that they can't change. And then they come and they're there before Joseph. And Judah pleads with Joseph to let him stay as a slave to Joseph instead of Benjamin, and says, how can I go back to my father if the boy is not with me? No, do not let me see the misery that would come upon my father. And Joseph has to turn aside and cry. because there's been that change of heart. And so he sends everybody out, and he's just there with his brothers. And he says to them, I am Joseph. And that normally would say, would it, now it's my turn to inflict problems for you, and I'm going to punish you for what you did to me. But that's not how God's grace works. And so he says, come close to me. I'm your brother Joseph, the one you sold into Egypt, and now do not be distressed and do not be angry with yourself selling me here, because it was to save lives that God sent me ahead of you. So he's saying, don't be upset about it. Don't blame yourselves for what happened, because it's all part of God's. He's not saying what they did was right, but he's saying that he, who had been sinned against, could see the purpose of God in it all. And there's this wonderful time of reconciliation as they embrace each other. And his brother Benjamin is there, and it's a very moving time. This family, God's family. You know, God's family is a place where reconciliation needs to take place. How sad it is that so often in churches there are splits and divisions and an unforgiving spirit. And it is so detrimental to the life of God's people and to the life of the individuals involved in it. And the grace of God somehow doesn't come to the fore. And it can go on for years and can be so destructive. But there's a wonderful power in forgiveness. Many of you may have read the writings of Corrie ten Boom. And she tells a story in one of her books about forgiveness. The book is called I'm Still Learning to Forgive. This is what she says. It's a remarkable story, but it teaches us something very important. It was in a church in Munich that I saw him, a balding, heavy-set man in a grey overcoat, a brown felt hat clutched beneath his hands. People were filing out of the basement room where I had just spoken, and moving along the rows of wooden chairs to the door at the rear. It was 1947, and I had come from Holland to defeated Germany with the message that God forgives. It was the truth they needed most to hear in that bitter, bombed-out land, and I gave them my favorite mental picture. Maybe because the sea is never far from a Hollander's mind, I like to think that that's where forgiven sins were thrown. When we confess our sins, I said, God casts them into the deepest ocean, gone forever. The solemn faces stared back at me, not quite daring to believe. There were never questions after a talk in Germany in 1947. People stood up in silence connected their coats, in silence left the room. And that's when I saw him, working his way forward against the others. One moment I saw the overcoat and the brown hat, the next, a blue uniform and a visored cap with its skull and crossbones. It came back with a rush. The huge room with its harsh overhead lights, the pathetic pile of dresses and shoes in the center of the floor, the shame of walking naked past this man. I could see my sister's frail form ahead of me, ribs sharp beneath the parchment skin. Betsy, how thin you were. Betsy and I had been arrested for concealing Jews in our home during the Nazi occupation of Holland. This man had been a guard at Ravensbrück concentration camp where we were sent. Now he was in front of me, hand thrust out. A fine message, Fraulein. How good it is to know that, as you say, all our sins are at the bottom of the sea. And I, who had spoken so glibly of forgiveness, fumbled in my pocketbook rather than take that hand. He would not remember me, of course. How could he remember one prisoner among those thousands of women? But I remembered him. And the leather crop swinging from his belt, I was face to face with one of my captors, and my blood seemed to freeze. You mentioned Ravensbrück in your talk, he was saying. I was a guard there. No, he did not remember me. But since that time, he went on, I have become a Christian. I know that God has forgiven me for the cruel things I did there. But I would like to hear it from your lips as well, Fraulein. Again, the hand came out. Will you forgive me? And I stood there, I whose sins had again and again to be forgiven and could not forgive. Betsy had died in that place. Could he erase her slow, terrible death simply for the asking? It could not have been many seconds that he stood there, hand held out, but to me it seemed hours, as I wrestled with the most difficult thing I had ever had to do. For I had to do it, I knew that. The message that God forgives has a prior condition, that we forgive those who have injured us. Jesus said, if you do not forgive men their trespasses, neither will your Father in heaven forgive your trespasses. I knew it not only as a commandment of God, but as a daily experience. Since the end of the war, I'd had a home in Holland for victims of Nazi brutality. Those who were able to forgive their former enemies were able also to return to the outside world and rebuild their lives, no matter what the physical scars. Those who nursed their bitterness remained invalids. It was as simple and as horrible as that. And still I stood there, with a coldness clutching my heart. But forgiveness is not an emotion. I knew that too. Forgiveness is an act of the will, and the will can function regardless of the temperature of the heart. Help, I prayed silently. I can lift my hand, I can do that much. You supply the feeling. And so woodenly, mechanically, I thrust my hand into the one stretched out to me. And as I did, an incredible thing took place. The current started in my shoulder, raced down my arm, sprang into our joined hands. And then this healing warmth seemed to flood my whole being, bringing tears to my eyes. I forgive you, brother, I cried, with all my heart. For a long moment we grasped each other's hands, the former guard and the former prisoner. I had never known God's love so intensely as I did then. Forgiving a terrible thing. The same thing happened in Egypt, and there was power in that forgiveness and in that reconciliation and in that sense of the love of God and the call of God to Abraham and to his descendants. And there was weeping in Egypt as there was weeping in that place in Germany as Corrie ten Boom forgave that man. And in her preface to the hiding place, this is what she says. This is what the past is for. Every experience God gives us, every person he puts in our lives, is the perfect preparation for the future only he can see. And you think of the life of Joseph. None of them could understand where God was leading them. But at that point where they were reconciled, where Joseph was the means of bringing about reconciliation, they were conscious of the love of God. And Joseph is a type, he's a figure in the Old Testament who foreshadows and points on to Jesus. You think of the Lord Jesus Christ coming into this world. He said to seek and to save that which was lost. And in John's Gospel we're told, for God did not send his Son into the world to condemn the world, but that the world through him might be saved. And every one of us needs to know God's forgiveness, and as we experience that forgiveness, to be ready to forgive others. And to, in doing that which we may find so hard, to experience the love of God in a deeper and a more wonderful way. Amen.